On the record. On News Talk.
With Pinergy. Supplying energy with insight to forward-thinking Irish businesses.
Now, when the following statement dropped, it didn't seem like it was going to be a story that would continue to roll in the news for several days afterwards. On the 1st of March 2021, the Central Bank of Ireland reprimanded and fined J.E. Davy €4.13 million in respect to four breaches of the European Community's Markets and Financial Instruments Regulations 2007. It doesn't sound like the most bombshell thing, and yet it continues to have ramifications and could indeed have many more ramifications given the central role that Davy plays in the Irish financial system. So to discuss that and more, I'm joined on the line now by the co-leader of the Social Democrats and TD for Dublin North West, Roisin Shotall. Roisin, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Gavin.
And thank you very much for taking your call this Sunday lunchtime. You have written a letter to the Governor of the Central Bank, Gabriel McLouf, outlining 10 questions that you still think that the Central Bank needs to answer. Can you bring us through some of those questions, please?
Sure, Gavin. Yeah, on Thursday evening, there was a session in the Dáil where the Minister for Finance came in and I posed some of these questions to him. He said at the time they weren't matters for him, they were matters for the regulator, which is the Central Bank. So on Friday, I wrote to the Central Bank setting out these 10 questions. And some of those questions relate to the detail of what happened after the agreement was reached with the individuals in Davy. So I was wondering, what about the 16 individuals themselves? What happened to the money that was made from that transaction? Is it the intention to name those 16 individuals? We know maybe five of them have been named already in the media, but what about the rest of them? Then what about the role of Davy in relation to the NTMA, where it's currently the only Irish-owned primary dealer of Irish bonds? Is it appropriate that that relationship would continue? Also, we know that Davy effectively runs the Irish Stock Exchange. How appropriate is that to continue? And, you know, there are other questions then in relation to a reported deal that was reached, an agreement reached between the Central Bank and Davy. Can that deal be published? And also, while we know that, you know, the outcome was a fine imposed on Davy, it's important just to understand the relative size of that fine relative to the turnover of Davy, which has a massive turnover. So, I mean, €4 million, while it seems like a lot of money, really only amounts to a slap in the wrist, and it's imposed on the company itself. And what about the individuals? What about bringing them to book? And another question I asked was, in relation to the activity that the 16 were involved in, was that actually criminal activity in 2014 when the behaviour occurred? And is it currently criminal activity? And, you know, how up to date and how effective is our fraud legislation and our company law at the moment? So there's a lot of questions there to be dealt with. I hope that the Governor of the Central Bank will come back to me with comprehensive replies in them all, because I think it's quite sickening for the public listening to this, you know, yet again, a financial institution engaging in impropriety and behaviour that is certainly unbecoming of a major financial institution. And this can't just be left lie, or, you know, there's no question, there can be no question of a line being drawn under it after three people resigned yesterday. There's a lot of outstanding questions that must be dealt with.
One of those questions that you just outlined there is whether this was criminal action at the time. And I know that that's an issue that Jim O'Callaghan, the Fianna Fáil TD, he's been telling one of the Sunday papers today that he wants to raise that at the Oireachtas Finance Committee on Tuesday, because the Central Bank Governor will be a witness then. Now, I know you yourself aren't a member of that committee, so you might be have difficulty, if you're able at all, to try and put some of these questions to him in person, so to speak, on Tuesday. But he's making the observation that he believes that there are certain regulations which have been on the books since 2014, that there may perhaps be a case of there being a breach of criminal law, and he wants to know why the Central Bank wouldn't have acted on that a little bit earlier.
Yes, exactly. And that is a key question. And too often we've seen in the past with this type of activity, you know, where people are named, supposedly shamed, though I think sometimes people involved in activity like this are shameless. And that's not enough. You know, people have to be brought to book. And for the sense of a sense of justice generally, I think it's imperative that people who breach the rules, to say the least, need to be seen to be made accountable. And there has to be there have to be consequences for people who engage in this kind of activity. I mean, another question that I had raised with the Governor of the Central Bank is whether or not the Central Bank had raised any of these issues with the Director of Corporate Enforcement, because there may well be a role there in terms of that office taking further action. So there's a lot of questions there that need to be answered. As you say, the Central Bank are before the Finance Committee on Tuesday. Unfortunately, at the moment, with the way committees are operating with the constraints of COVID, there's very, very little time and they're very unsatisfactory. And for that reason, I thought it was better to set out those questions in a letter. And I would expect to get a response by way of letter from the Governor.
The chairman of that committee, Fianna Fáil's John McGuinness, made the observation during the week that he doesn't believe it's terribly fair or appropriate that the 16 names not formally be made known. Obviously, we now know some of the names of the 16 people involved because they've effectively identified themselves. But John McGuinness was making the observation that if you went into a corner shop and tried to steal an apple, you could end up before the local circuit or district court and could end up having your name published. And he doesn't understand why the names of the 16 people involved in this haven't also been identified.
Absolutely, I completely agree with that, and that was one of the questions in my letter. Does the Central Bank intend to name all 16? We're entitled to know who they are, and you know, it seems that most of these are going to continue working in Davy. Now, is that appropriate? So you know, these are people that engaged in pretty bad behaviour, and it's important that they are named. But I mean, that other question then: what happened to all the money that was made in this transaction? Are these guys just going to pocket that?
And indeed, how much was it, considering the gravity of the fine?
Exactly,
did that influence
exactly,
the fine, or
yeah,
where
yeah,
does it tally yeah up in proportion to it as well? There is one other issue that I don't know if it is dealt with by your letter, but there's one other issue which some business journalists are noting in their copy today, which is that despite their resignations, these three individuals who now are no longer employed by Davy will still remain fairly significant shareholders of Davy, or at least as it stands right now, they are significant shareholders in Davy. Does that raise question marks as to how much they themselves might profit from the future performance of an institution that they themselves had to recuse themselves from?
Absolutely. And I mean, just trying to read between the lines of the statement that Davy issued yesterday, it's hard to know just what involvement that these individuals will have. The statement gave the impression initially that, you know, they were cutting their ties with Davy, but it seems that they are continuing on in fairly significant roles and will continue to benefit from the behaviour, from the activity of the company. So, you know, it's not quite the sanction that it first appeared.
What do you do about that though, Roisin? If it's a situation where these people had, you know, stock options or share options in their company, they are shareholders in it, I mean, you can't surely legally force them to divest themselves of the shares that they've justly built up over time.
No, you can't. But these people have been leading lights in that company for a very long time. This activity occurred in 2014. It has to be said, there are other, there's a record there in relation to the company. They do have some form in relation to involvement in different activities down through the years, which some people would have questions about. So, you know, this was known for quite some time. It's 6 years since this activity occurred, and it seems that Davy were quite happy to continue to have these leading lights in the company continue in their very influential roles. So, I mean, that raises questions about the ethos and the culture around some of our financial institutions. And I think there's a lot of people in business and outside of business who find this extremely distasteful. And, you know, some people find it quite abhorrent. And, you know, I think a lot of the clients of Davy will probably make up their own minds about that. But from the point of view of the state and the role that Davy plays in kind of official dealings, that's why I raised the whole question of the role that it has with the NTMA as its principal broker. Is that appropriate? I don't believe that it is. And also then in relation to its very central role in the stock exchange. And I think think there are big questions that the government now really needs to consider. It's a matter of what is the standard that is set in our financial institutions. And certainly from on the basis of this particular share deal, that standard is a pretty low one.
Can I take a few minutes to bring you to some other topics? It is almost 5 years ago now since the last DAL was formed and you were appointed as the chair of the Oireachtas Committee on the Future of Healthcare, which ended up resulting in the Sláintecare report. And Sláintecare was everyone's buzzword in the general election last year until suddenly there was a massive global pandemic on the cards. 12 months on, do you think that Sláintecare remains a viable path for the future of Irish healthcare, or has the pandemic just turned all of that thinking on its head?
I absolutely do believe that Sláintecare is a viable path. It is actually just attempting to do within the Irish health system what every other country in Europe does, and that is have a properly functioning universal public healthcare system. And like those kind of systems exist everywhere else. It's standard that the vast majority of people, they understand, you pay your taxes, and in return you get access to good quality public health services. And like even in the UK, which isn't a terribly good example of a public health service, it has the NHS for a long time, obviously, but that system has been underfunded by successive Conservative governments. But even in that system, which is underfunded, about 90% of people are more than happy to use the system, and only about 10% feel they want to take out private health insurance for, you know, the added extras. So, you know, it is a very, having access to universal healthcare is a very fundamental aspect of any modern democracy. Ireland is an outlier in that respect. So at least at this point, we have a plan. We have all parties in the DAL theoretically signed up to it anyway. It has been kind of, there has been a setback to a certain extent because of COVID, and understandably. But at the same time, when you look at, or when you talk to people who are involved in the health service, and you see some of the things that have happened last year, because they had to happen, where activity was switched out of the acute hospitals into the community, where there are more diagnostic facilities provided within the community, where there was a lot of innovation because they had to do that. They had to shift activity out of hospitals to make space for COVID patients. A lot of that kind of thing, you know, has been very successful from the point of view of changing a mindset and changing practice. And you'll recall that last year, Paul Reid referred to what they were doing within the health service to cater for COVID as being Sláintecare on speed. And, yeah, you know, to a great extent, it has forced that kind of change. And the key thing is now that there should be no going back to the old way of doing it.
I suppose
when we get out of COVID.
I suppose that's the question, though, that arises, Roisin, because so much money has been sunk into, and completely appropriately, has been sunk into dealing with the pressures that have been raised by COVID-19, that one imagines when the pandemic has been in past and the crisis for the health service caused by the pandemic is no more, there would probably be an appetite to rein back in the spending and to not use the same amount of, you know, vastly inflated capital budgets and current budgets that they've had for the last couple of years to deal with this. That basically, when the virus is gone, there'll be an appetite to try and bring the budgets back to the way they used to be.
Well, Gavin, I think it's important to bear in mind that what Sláintecare entails is a major shifting of healthcare activity away from acute hospitals, which is the most expensive place, into the community. And when you bear in mind that about 70% of activity within the health service relates to chronic illness, the vast bulk of that chronic illness should be catered for in the community, either by GPs in primary care or by nurse-led services. I mean, nurses are fantastic, qualified to manage chronic illness. So a person with diabetes, for example, or a chronic heart disease, for example, should be maintained and managed within the community, ideally by nurses or GPs. And they shouldn't have to go to hospitals except on rare occasions. So the important thing is that Sláintecare is about a much lower cost model of care that is primarily provided at community level. And that's, you know, that results in a much lower cost base. It results in better health outcomes, but also much better value for money. And for example, if you take, you know, the fact that we have at any one time outside of, you know, in normal times outside of COVID, obviously, we have maybe 500 or 600 people who are ready to be discharged from hospital, but they have to stay on in acute hospital beds because money isn't provided at community level for home care. Or we consider the fact that there is a statutory right to nursing home care, while the vast majority of older people want to stay in their own homes and have home help services or home care.
Okay.
So it's that thing of switching from what's an expensive model, which we have been operating, to a lower cost model, which also gives, of course, better health outcomes.
Okay.
So I think a lot of those lessons will have been learned.
I think
you have to spend
a lot of money first to make it cheaper, but I suppose I take your point on that. Just briefly before I let you go, your party had its national conference last weekend, obviously conducted online because of the times that's in it. It prompted what you probably now consider to be a fairly predictable slew of think pieces around whether there is a market for a party like your own and that of the Labour Party, which you were once a member of as well. Constant speculation around whether there should be a more strategic relationship or even a full-on merger between your two parties. Where do you stand on that, or what are your thoughts?
Well, that's not something we're contemplating at all. I have to say, we're a party, one of the newest parties in the country, less than 6 years old. I think our progress has been pretty good, considering it's only 6 years since we less than 6 years since we started. There was Catherine Murphy and myself at the local elections 2 years ago. We trebled the number of council seats that we had. In last year's general election, we trebled the number of TDs, and we're really delighted to have 6 TDs now and 4 new extremely impressive TDs. We're growing very rapidly. I think recent opinion polls would indicate that. We saw in last weekend's Red Sea poll that we're now on a poll rating of 6%. We've doubled our poll rating since the election last year.
But you want to treble the Dáil seats next time around, and all well and good,
and
good luck to you, but you could double your seats right now if you merge with the Labour Party.
But we're a completely different party, and there's a different culture there. And we're a party that is very much, you know, has a very, very good gender balance. We're a party that is growing very rapidly with young people in particular. We saw, in last week's poll, we have a support from about 10% of under 25s. We have a huge increase in our membership. We're growing very rapidly. Last weekend at our conference, an online conference, we had 700 delegates registered at that. So we're growing strongly. We're about the future, not the past. And we intend to continue growing like that.
Not sure if everyone on the other side of the fence would agree that there are so many differences between yourself and the Labour Party, but I think you'll agree that that is perhaps a story for another day. In the meantime, we will leave it there for now. Roisin Shortall, co-leader of the Social Democrats, thank you very much for joining us this lunchtime on The Record.